It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll look at the work done by a group of pandemic frontline workers we might not always think about, garbage truck drivers and various other waste collection workers. We learn how the pandemic is affecting their jobs in Wisconsin and around the nation. First, the retail world has been making some big shifts slowly for a while now. Department stores closing, malls struggling, e-commerce on the rise, and big businesses like Amazon and Walmart drawing more and more sales. Our next guest says that COVID-19 has done for retail what it's done for many things, sped up already existing trends and accelerated big changes to the way we shop and the cities and towns we live in. Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, technology, and the media. He's the author of the book Hitmakers and the host of the podcast Crazy Genius. He wrote the piece, The Pandemic Will Change American Retail Forever. Derek, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's look at right now for a moment before we look out to the future. We know there's been a big slowdown in the economy. You went out looking at businesses and talking to people. What is our current state of affairs when it comes to how we shop?
Well, the current state of affairs is that a lot of businesses that would otherwise be open are forcibly shut, and they will remain closed even as the economy slowly reopens, because if it reopens, they'll be reopening under a new protocol of socially distanced life. So, you know, crowded bars, crowded stadiums, crowded restaurants, crowded stores, all these things are going to be either impossible by local or state law or extremely unadvisable by public health. If you look at the way that Americans are spending their money, you do already see some really interesting shifts. So, for example, you see a huge increase at grocery stores and liquor stores, which in March had their best month of growth on record, according to official government reports. On the other hand, you look at something like travel spending, airlines, hotels, cruises, all of those are down more than 100% if you include refunds. Department stores, clothing stores, restaurants, those are all down close to 60-70%, which is, you know, truly depression territory. So you do see some pockets of resiliency, but for the most part, Americans are, they're holding back. They're staying home. And as a result, they're just not spending money on what they used to.
We've seen a rise in the amount of online shopping over the years. And people are probably looking to that more now that they can actually go to a lot of the stores they might be used to. Do you think this is going to create a new habit of online shopping for people who maybe hadn't done it that much previously?
I think that's a good way of putting it for those who hadn't been doing it previously, because I think there's a certain swath of Americans who had been doing quite a lot of shopping online that did not need a global plague to get them to shop online. That said, I don't think that online shopping is a part of the sort of national infrastructure for older Americans, and that has clearly shifted. You've seen grocery deliveries, for example, ordered online just absolutely soar. One statistic that I think really encapsulates what's going on is the share of total retail spending that's happening online. So right now it's about, 14-15%, and that number has been growing by about 1 point every single year. So 13-15% every single year. Right now you have reports suggesting that 25% of all retail spending is going online, and that it will remain at around 25% for the next year or so. That effectively means that the e-commerce revolution has concentrated one decade's worth of growth in a matter of months. That's what I mean when I talk about the big acceleration. You see a lot of trends not necessarily being invented by the pandemic, but clearly and massively accelerated by it.
Another trend that had been out there, it's no secret, it can be tough to keep a small business afloat. We see industry consolidation in lots of different markets, including retail. How is that playing out now in the pandemic, small versus big?
Well, I think the big are likely to get bigger for several reasons. First, they have more resources to hold their breath over the next few months, the next few quarters. You know, you look at a restaurant, typical restaurant maybe has enough money to get itself through, 3 weeks without any income. For a chain like Ruth's Chris Steakhouse or Chipotle, they have $100 million or hundreds of millions of dollars of cash on hand that they can, you know, burn through a little bit to weather the storm. Those are pre-existing strengths, but I think they'll redouble in the crisis because these companies, larger companies, will have more access to liquidity. They have deeper relationships with banks. They have more resources to change their establishments, you know, put temperature checks at the front, you know, put, you know, extra Lysol wipes and extra hand sanitizers within the establishment, break up some of the tables and socially distance the tables. So for a variety of reasons, I'm talking about restaurants right here, but I think you'll see it across the economy. I do think the big will get bigger because they had more resources entering the crisis, and they'll be able to spend those resources down as the crisis continues.
And here we are with these small business assistance programs through the CARES Act from Congress, and now a follow-up onto that. And a lot of the aid going to, you know, businesses like the ones you mentioned, Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, businesses that I think when most people think small, it's not what they're thinking about.
Yeah, it's not what they're thinking about. And, you know, I don't begrudge any company trying to save itself during a plague. I don't want to, you know, name names and do a blame game with individual companies. I think it falls to the government to create a program that's big enough to save all American businesses, regardless of their size. You know, people who work for Chipotle are people, too. You know, they deserve a program that saves their jobs as much as a mom and pop store deserves a program that saves theirs. Now, clearly the way that PPP has played out, at least in the last few weeks, has made it tougher for small businesses to be saved, made it easier for larger businesses with pre-existing relationships with banks to be saved. I definitely am not rooting for that outcome, but I would hope that the government goes back and creates a really, really big follow-up program for this country, because I want to save all the businesses, not just the big ones and not just the small ones. In one way, a metaphor that came to mind as I was thinking about the problems with the PPP program, with the payroll protection program, is it's kind of like it's like a bread line. It's like a city creating a bread line that can only feed a third of its residents. Well, let's say that some residents who are rich got bread and some residents who were poor didn't get bread. I don't think that's the fault of the rich residents or the poor residents. I think it's the fault of the city that created a bread line that could only feed one third of its residents. We need to be able to feed all of our businesses, save all of our businesses. Otherwise, it's not just a matter of some businesses, you know, going bankrupt and others not. You're just going to see millions of people lose their jobs. And that's something I don't want to see.
Talking to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic about the future of retail, how it's being affected by the pandemic. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. If you're a shopper, how has this changed the way you shop? If you're a business owner, how is this affecting your retail business? 800-642-1234. Another trend we've talked a lot about on the show here, Derek, over the years, big retailers, the Sears's and JCPenney's and things like that, you know, on the verge, facing trouble long term. How is this hitting them now?
Yeah, so I definitely want to distinguish the point I'm about to make from the point that I just made. I just said that the big are going to get bigger, and that's true for the big in parts of retail that are resilient. So Amazon will get bigger. Walmart will get bigger. Costco, I believe, will get bigger. Chain restaurants, I think, will expand. But there is a category within retail that has a lot of big players that is not going to make it, I don't think, through this crisis, and that is the department store. I do think that the year 2020 will, in many respects, at least from the history books, mark the death of that 200-year-old innovation known as the department store. You have Neiman Marcus looking to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Macy's has furloughed 100,000 workers. Sears has been on death's door for years. Same goes for JCPenney. I think that these department stores that don't offer the same choice, the same variety, especially the same kind of food options, a place like Walmart or Costco, I think they're going to find that more Americans make the determination, especially during a period of lockdown, that Amazon is just a better department store. And a lot of and the internet is just a better department store than a physical department store. So I think that for a lot of those stores that were already facing a difficult decade in the 2020s, I think their end will be accelerated, just as the growth of some other big companies will be accelerated as well.
At the core of all this, Derek, you are concerned that we're going to see big changes in our downtowns, whether that's a downtown big city, a downtown commercial district of a smaller town, and all points in between. What do you worry about? What do you hope for?
Well, I'll talk about what I worry about first. I was born in the D.C. area. I went to school in the Chicago area, and I lived in New York for 7 years before moving back to Washington, D.C. So I spent basically my entire life in cities or in suburbs very close to cities. And what I love about cities is their density, their variety, their diversity, the diversity of people, of languages, of cuisines, and the energy, the thrum of cities. And I think that a plague, a pandemic, unwinds a lot of that. It makes density dangerous. Right now, we're seeing immigration, the administration trying to shut down immigration to this country. And we see global migration being effectively shut down by lockdowns going on around the world. I worry about the future of mom and pops in cities that are responsible for giving neighborhoods their unique face. Because without those independent stores, every store is a chain. And if every store is a chain in cities, that means that everywhere you go looks like everywhere that you've been. It means that West Hollywood and the West End and Upper West Side aren't as distinct as they once used to be. So I'm afraid that the pandemic will be bad for all of those reasons. At the same time, I do think that if the pandemic is a shock to cities as they exist, and if more people leave cities and fewer people arrive in them, then one inevitable thing that will happen is that cities will get cheaper. And if cities get cheaper, then that means that the middle class that couldn't afford urban residence in the last few years, they can move back in. And maybe we can see not only the middle class immigrants, some artists and countercultural people and, the weirdos and eccentrics that have given cities their life and their history, maybe they can move back into cities and make them interesting in the long run. So I'm looking at this short-term future, which I think is quite grim, and this longer-term future, which I think is a little bit rosier.
We're talking to Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, technology, and the media. Talking about a piece he wrote, The Pandemic Will Change American Retail Forever. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. How do you think our retail industry and shopping, maybe in your hometown, will look post-COVID-19? How has the way you shop changed since this all began? More online shopping or more intentional support of small businesses? Are you working to try to get curbside pickup from your local store? If you are in retail, big or small, love to hear your perspective on all of this. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, technology, and the media. We're talking about the future of retail, heavily disrupted by the coronavirus pandemic right now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has all of this changed the way you buy stuff, groceries, clothes, whatever? Do you think this is going to be a long-term change? If you started buying online, are you going to keep doing it? Have you made an effort to support smaller businesses or bigger businesses in your area if you work in retail? How has this changed your life right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Dan is with us in Mosinee. Dan, hello.
Hello there. I agree to a point with your guest, but I still think that when it comes to some things, people are still going to want to go to a store. I have a hard time believing you can buy everything you want online, especially even clothes. I mean, people want to try clothes on for sizing, and I don't believe the pandemic's going to last forever. I mean, there will be a cure eventually. Doesn't mean we won't have another one, but how are people going to shop for clothes strictly online if they want to go and try things on? That's the question, I guess, for your guest. And I'll take the answer off here. Thank you.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Derek, some people want that in-person experience and they want to try their stuff on for sure.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's a great point. And I guess I want to make a specific answer to the question and a more general point. Also, I'll first answer specifically. When it comes to apparel, there's lots of ways to shop online. The vast majority of my friends do the vast majority of their clothes shopping online. They'll buy clothes, or they'll buy sort of subscriptions to, you know, box companies that will essentially take their measurements and send them a bunch of clothes that they can essentially send back the clothes they don't like. And the sending back is free. There's a lot of free returns across the clothing industry, which is one thing that has made it harder for a lot of operators to stay in the physical store business. So you already have this sort of mixing of online and offline shopping that's happening with clothes for a lot of young people. And I do think that because a lot of cities and areas are going to remain shut down for a while, and people still want to buy new clothes potentially, you know, older people might experiment with some of those free returns policies and sort of box subscription companies to shop for themselves. To the larger point, which I think is about, you know, am I predicting the end of physical store retail? Absolutely not. I'm not predicting the end of physical store retail. I believe that this crisis will have an end, and B, believe that even before it ends, people will go back to stores. But the stores that we go back to won't be the same kind of stores. They will be stores that will be socially distanced, not only by local law, but also by consumer interest. I don't want to be in a crowded restaurant right now. I don't want to be in a crowded Apple store. I don't want to be in a crowded Target or J. Crew. And as a result, I think a lot of people share my position here. And as a result, these stores are just going to be less crowded. So how do you do the same amount of business if you don't have the same number, if you don't have the same crowds that you used to in your store? Well, almost by definition, that means more of your business has to be distributed. It has to happen outside of your store. And that means it's going to happen online. So I think that the online offline mix that is already, it's already a fact of life for the vast majority of shoppers who do a little bit of researching online, and then maybe they buy in store, or they, you know, buy online and they, you know, return in store. I just think that that mix is going to shift a little bit more toward e-commerce because of the lockdown that we're all experiencing.
Dan, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Anita now in Lindenhurst. Anita, hello.
This is really interesting because I'm kind of going through, you know, a real change here. It's a cultural change, a lot of our friends think. But one of the industries that has grown out of this, not just want to look at things and how they, the things that are already here are affected, but the new things coming in. And I'm being very careful because I'm a senior citizen, and I'm employing these various shopping and delivery services like Shipt and Instacart. And I'm finding out there's a world of difference, but they wouldn't be doing the business that they're doing were it not for the necessity right now. And for instance, like Instacart, you think these are just local yokels. They're not. That is a couple of $1 billion a year industry based out of San Francisco. Shipt is smaller, but the one thing about Instacart is you can't get through to them. They have a wall around them. If you've got something to say or you're not happy, forget it. The other one, Shipt, they're fantastic. And the thing is that, you know, even that is another way of shopping. But this has brought about some new businesses. So a lot of those housewives and even guys and college students that lost their jobs, they're doing this now.
Anita, thanks a lot for the call. A shift to businesses like Shipt and Instacart and others. And Anita is tapping into that world she didn't know was out there for the first time, Derek.
Yeah. Anita is, it's almost as if I placed her there because she's making exactly the point that I was trying to make, which is that, you know, Instacart existed and Shipt existed. And a lot of these sort of, you know, e-commerce options and delivery options existed. But their modal consumer before the pandemic was a younger person. It was someone living in a downtown area who's in their 20s or 30s, who has this extremely comfortable relationship with making all of these orders on the internet. But today what you're seeing, I think, and I think there's many Anitas out there, you see older people, you see senior citizens picking up on this. And recognizing, wait, you know, delivery groceries can work, and delivery food maybe can work, and an all delivery economy, or maybe a mostly delivery economy can work for me. It isn't a huge interruption to my life, and in fact, it might even make parts of my life more convenient. This is what I'm talking about, not not the zeroing out of the physical retail sector, not the end of visiting stores, but an important and potentially semi-permanent shift toward e-commerce among people who previously didn't realize how much they could do on the internet.
Anita, thanks for that call. We're talking to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic about the present and future of retail during the COVID-19 outbreak. Sean joins us now in La Crosse. Sean, hello.
I appreciate your guest very much. In fact, I might get a subscription to The Atlantic. They have a lot of good content coming out. It's odd to think of the Mall of America being someday like a museum where you see these stores that are nowhere else in the economy. I think the one possible survivor could be a store that is actually Wisconsin born and bred, and that would be Kohl's. One of the reasons that I think that is they got ahead of the online internet economy and did start a fairly robust online presence. Online pickup at store. They started actually handling Amazon returns. And so I don't think you're ever going to ever get rid of instant gratification and the shopping experience. I mean, the fact that we have to wait even a day now, even for an Amazon purchase, people are going to want to go to a shopping store, a department store, and have that experience.
Sean, thanks a lot for the call. Derek, kind of the hybrid, the brick and mortar that has various kinds of online presence.
Yeah, you know, that description of Kohl's reminded me. I spoke to one source who's a lecturer at Harvard and a retail consultant for retailers all over the world. And I said, you know, give me some really interesting examples of some companies in other countries that are a vision of what the future of an American retailer could be. And he said, I want to tell you about a Chinese supermarket chain called Hema. And Hema is operated by Alibaba, which is an e-commerce giant in China. It's a little bit like their Amazon. So Hema, it essentially triples as a high-end grocer, a restaurant, and an online fulfillment center. So what that means is that if you walk into a Hema, it looks like a Kroger or a Whole Foods. It looks like a grocer, but you buy everything with your phone. You scan the item with your phone, you know, the Brussels sprouts, the oranges, the mushrooms. You scan the item with your phone before you put it into your cart. And so the checkout is partially automated in that way. There's a restaurant there. Again, you pay entirely through your phone. But really importantly, 60% of their orders are online. Those people don't walk into the grocer. Maybe that's a direction that America's supermarkets could go into.
Derek, always good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Derek Thompson with The Atlantic looking at the future of retail. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. More to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Since the middle of March, hospitals in Wisconsin have been putting off non-essential medical procedures to make room for a potential surge in COVID-19 cases. Now, some medical centers are resuming elective care. We'll talk about what that means for patients and hospitals coming up. First, the COVID-19 pandemic is shining a light on an essential service that we may take for granted in our daily lives. Over 400,000 people are part of America's waste collection and disposal companies, taking our trash and recycling away from the curb on a schedule. It's an essential service still going on during the pandemic. Our next guests are here to talk about the workers performing the vital job and the kind of protections that are and aren't in place for them. Melissa Johnson starts us off. She's the president of Associated Recyclers of Wisconsin and the director of Marathon County's Solid Waste Department. Melissa, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
Has daily life changed for waste collection workers in your neck of the woods?
Well, you know, handling waste has always been sort of a challenging job, and certainly waste workers have used all kinds of protocols to stay safe from the stuff you throw out of your house. Imagine all of that hairy, moldy stuff you grab from the refrigerator and throw in the garbage along with some diapers, and We've worked safety into our everyday lives for a very long time. Now, during COVID, of course, we're amping that up a little bit, actually quite a bit, because we're frontline workers. Imagine if your garbage wasn't taken away when you set it out. So we are working very hard to keep everybody safe.
So what kind of additional protections are you taking or seeing other departments around the state taking?
Well, it depends. Now, like at landfills, my facility, for instance, in Marathon County, we used to do a lot of assistance to customers who came in. You know, they needed help with helping to offload something. We don't do that anymore. My staff has to stay at least 6 to 10 feet away from other people. We are no longer accepting cash. There's only credit card transactions or debit card transaction. We have a large plexiglass barrier between customers that come in and my scale operator. You know, a number of things. Our household hazardous waste programs, people, some of them were closed. The ones that are open, we don't allow people to get out of their vehicles. My staff grabs things from their cars. There's very little interaction with the public. And of course, if you've got a material recovery facility, and that's where all your recyclables are sorted, those people are working on an assembly line. And unfortunately, those stations are rather close. So we're starting to see the implementation of additional PPE and barriers between those stations to keep people safe.
For those of us who use your services, are there things we can do, whether it's at our curbside disposal or going to a facility, that can help keep you all safer?
Well, I think the big thing right now is and when people call and say, are you open? You know, they're wondering, because so many places are unfortunately closed, we're considered an essential service. And so we are open. However, because you're home and you're looking at that basement that you've wanted to clean for 6 years, but now you've got the time for it, is it essential to put yourself in harm and put my staff in harm by coming out to the landfill to dispose of those things? So those are the kind of things that, you know, we're really asking the public to think about. We're open. You know, public or solid waste facilities, recycling facilities, we're here to serve. That's our job. We take pride in our ability to protect human health and the environment. But is it essential for you to be out and about with that load of garbage? Can it wait? That's one of the biggest things we're looking at. The other thing is the waste volumes are up at the curb because people are home more now. So, again, is it essential to throw it out? Is it something that can be used up? Always waste reduction first.
Melissa, thanks so much for joining us today.
My absolute pleasure, and have a good day.
You too. That's Melissa Johnson, president of Associated Recyclers of Wisconsin and the director of Marathon County's Solid Waste Department. We continue our conversation about waste management as a frontline operation now. Adam Minter is with us, columnist for Bloomberg Opinion and author of several books, including Secondhand, Travels in the Global Garage Sale. He wrote a piece, Garbage Workers Are on the Virus Frontlines Too. Adam, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you looked back in history to the big flu pandemic of just over 100 years ago when trash collection didn't happen as smoothly. Can you paint us a picture?
Well, yeah, in 1918, you know, the last thing people were really thinking about at the beginning of the pandemic was that what to do with the waste and how it would impact the people who were picking it up. And it turned out that was a great mistake. You know, in some of the bigger locations for the outbreak, for example, in Baltimore, at least a quarter of the city's garbage workers weren't reporting for work at the peak of the pandemic simply because they'd gotten sick. And so that kind of feeds on itself. One, you're sending these people home, they're infecting their families. Two, you know, that leaves behind piles of trash. And when you have trash, especially trash that's, you know, been exposed, to a virus, you have the possibility of transmission. And so that happened in Baltimore. It happened in San Francisco. It happened in Philadelphia. It happened in Kansas City. And there are accounts, you know, in San Francisco and Kansas City of children playing on these piles of trash that had been thrown out from houses that had this flu. So, you know, that's not going to happen this time, but it does serve as a warning that these wastes that we generate in our homes, especially when we have so many people self-quarantining, some of whom may be asymptomatic, that there is the possibility that could be a vector for transmission.
We heard about how Marathon County here in Wisconsin is adapting to this. You kind of surveyed places around the country, including, I think, here in Wisconsin in Platteville. What kind of things did you see as far as adaptations to the current outbreak?
Sure. Well, there's a few things going on. I mean, perhaps, the most important, and it's long overdue in some cases, is just that people are getting personal protective equipment. Now, this has always been recommended. I mean, even on the federal level, that municipalities, that companies give their workers, equipment to use when they're collecting the trash or sorting the trash in sorting facilities. So this could be gloves. This could be eye protection. Masks have never been recommended, but we're seeing them adapted more and more. And so you're seeing that happen, and you're seeing workers embrace it. I mean, workers have, it's not a new story. Workers sometimes will be given these things and they don't want to wear them. But in a more in-depth sense, you're seeing, for instance, on the recycling sorting lines, you're seeing workers being spaced out more. So as your previous guest indicated, when you sort recyclables, that's usually done on lines that look like assembly lines in some sense, and people are at very close quarters. We've seen municipalities around the United States shrink the number of garbage workers on a truck from 3 to 2. The idea being to reduce the amount of or to increase the amount of social distancing. Lengthening out shifts again with the idea that you want to have a smaller number of people being exposed. So there are steps being taken like that.
Is there a change in the kinds of waste and the volumes of kinds of waste as we have this big shift from, many people being in offices and other workplaces and now being in their homes?
Yes, there really is, and we're just now starting to get some of the data. For example, Phoenix, Arizona reported that they're seeing in March, they saw a 20% increase in the amount of solid waste coming out of homes compared to March of 2019. In New York City, the amount of, and the way New York City sorts its waste is interesting, but the amount of metal, plastics, glass and containers, which is one category, during the same period was up just under 12% for March of 2020 compared to March of 2019. So those are huge surges in waste, and it's really creating, and it's not just those municipalities. Those are just two to give you an example. I think if you surveyed most municipalities in Wisconsin, you'd find something similar going on. It's an open question right now in most places. Is this getting equaled out, balanced out by the amount of waste that's not turning up from commercial facilities? Certainly we're seeing in the recycling stream, there's much less recycling coming out of, say, grocery stores, other, retailers, places that would be using cardboard boxes than there would be office paper, which is a very important input into recycled paper, especially tissue like toilet paper is way down. It comes out of offices. And so that's leaving, say, some of your Wisconsin paper makers who may make tissue scrambling for raw materials. So it's a really interesting time in the markets that use these waste products.
How about medical waste, whether it's coming from medical facilities or it's just, that used mask you've got at home?
Yeah, well, the U.S. In particular has a very good, very advanced, very robust medical waste system that services hospitals, clinics, et cetera, anything where you actually have medical personnel, clinicians. There's more than enough capacity, not being overwhelmed, which is good because we did see the medical waste systems in China, in Wuhan, in Italy being overwhelmed. They simply didn't have enough. But it is a big question as to what the impact is of all these masks, all these gloves. What happens in a home where somebody is asymptomatic? They're drinking out of a bottle of Coke and they put that in the recycling and somebody touches that. There's all kinds of data out there and it's all over the place on, how long the virus sustains itself on surfaces in aerosols. And the answer is, we don't know. But there is some disturbing data out there suggesting that, waste workers are getting infected by the stuff that's not in the medical waste stream, but in the normal municipal waste stream. Just in New York, the Department of Sanitation there has had 350 plus infections and 5 deaths due to the virus. So that's causing quite a bit of nervousness, as you can imagine, across the waste industry.
Now, we heard from our previous guest, Melissa Johnson, with Marathon County's Solid Waste Department. hey, maybe think about how much stuff you're throwing away in the first place, and maybe the stuff you buy, think about how you're going to throw it away. Is this a time, do you think, and I know you think about these issues a lot, Adam,
sure.
that is this a time to start thinking about what we use and what we get rid of?
Well, absolutely. I mean, just in terms of the spring cleaning, I mean, by all means, do your spring cleaning. But if you really want to help out waste workers in the waste industry and the recycling industry, hold off on bringing that stuff in. You know, bag it, garage, and wait till later. When the big rush to the Goodwills and the Salvation Armies is done, or if you're going to throw it away, again, there's you know, really huge amounts of waste coming to the curb right now, and a lot of that stuff isn't bagged, requires waste workers to touch. So, you know, maybe hold off on it to a time when there's just less waste going into the system. And yes, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, my last book really focused on the amount of stuff that Americans generate in their homes and how there really aren't markets for most of it. And I think this is a really good time to think about when you buy that thing, what is the ultimate fate of it going to be? And you know, it's not always going to be the case that, you know, the stuff that you're generating in your home is an immediate health risk potentially because of a virus on its surface, but it's an excellent time to sort of do that exercise and ask yourself, what is the impact of all this excess stuff that I'm throwing away or taking to the Goodwills or the Salvation Armies on society as a whole and on individuals? It's a very important question.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Adam Minter, columnist for Bloomberg Opinion and author of several books, including Secondhand Travels in the Global Garage Sale. He wrote the piece Garbage Workers Are on the Virus Front Lines, too. We also heard from Melissa Johnson, president of Associated Recyclers of Wisconsin and director of Marathon County's Solid Waste Department, looking at how our waste disposal system and the workers in that system are dealing with the COVID-19 outbreak. Coming up, we'll find out why some Wisconsin hospitals are starting up elective surgeries again. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, caring for a loved one with dementia has some special challenges right now. We'll hear some advice from an expert on aging and long-term care about staying connected to a loved one with dementia during the coronavirus outbreak. First, some hospitals in the state say they're getting back to doing surgeries they had put off since the middle of last month. At the recommendation of federal health officials, care that was deemed non-essential was postponed in order to accommodate a potential surge in COVID-19 patients. So far, medical centers in Wisconsin have been able to handle the cases without too much trouble. Right now, the Department of Health Services says there are about 350 people hospitalized with the coronavirus in Wisconsin. That means that people who have been waiting to have their elective surgeries may soon be able to have them. Shemaine Mills is a Madison-based reporter with Wisconsin Public Radio who frequently covers health issues. Shemaine, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
What are we hearing, Shemaine, from hospitals in the state when it comes to bringing these non-essential surgeries back into action?
Well, these surgeries stopped in mid-March at the advice of federal health officials who said, we need enough equipment to do these surgeries safely. And by equipment, I mean personal protection equipment, masks, gowns, whatnot. And they are starting to resume at some hospitals, not across the state, but a good number of them, because they feel that they have the beds open and they can do these procedures safely. They now know how to isolate those who are sick. They test people, they screen people before they come in. So they feel they can go ahead and do these surgeries they had delayed.
Is there a timeline, or does it vary from hospital to hospital, as to when these postponed surgeries are going to start happening?
Well, Froedtert in Milwaukee, which is associated with the Medical College of Wisconsin, they're going to start May 1st. Some surgeries have already started. Three Madison hospitals put out a release saying they are resuming these surgeries. I talked to a gentleman. He's been waiting 6 weeks for hernia surgery, and he's going to have it May 5th. So he's pretty excited to get this done.
I speak from experience. That's a surgery you want to get over with. You just want to be done with it.
So
I felt for him in your reporting there, Shemaine, for sure. Now, we're also seeing at the same time, Shemaine, some hospitals furloughing workers because a lot of these elective surgeries or non-essential surgeries, that is slowing the money flow to hospitals. What's happening there?
Well, hospitals experienced this double whammy where they were losing revenue because they had to cancel elective procedures for a while also their expenses were going up tremendously. They had to create these negative pressure rooms to contain the COVID-19 virus in patients who had it. They also had to buy this protective equipment, masks and gowns, at inflated prices. So at the same time, they're getting less money in. They're having to spend more money to do these emergency procedures. So it's been tough for them. Hospitals around the state are losing millions of dollars a week.
Talking to Shemaine Mills, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, looking at hospitals around Wisconsin, how they're dealing with COVID-19, elective surgeries, as we heard, that had been postponed, starting up again, some furloughs of employees. Shemaine, I know there was some help intended for hospitals in the latest round of federal relief money. Is that something Wisconsin hospitals are hoping it can alleviate some of those difficulties you were talking about?
Well, the first round was $100 billion, but they just approved more. It wasn't enough. And some of the hospitals haven't got the money yet. So there's the problem with the lag in getting the funds. And that's part of the reason you see some of the hospitals starting to resume their procedures. They need the funds. And that's also why you're seeing the furloughs at a number of hospitals, along with delaying capital projects. Building construction is on hold until they have a firmer hold on their finances.
And now, Shemaine, I want to give a listen to a guest we talked to yesterday, Dr. John Ohoro, an infectious disease specialist from Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He also works in La Crosse. He talked about another issue coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic. Here's a listen.
And it's important to know that hospitals really are not the hot spot at the moment, because something that's been more and more evident across the nation is that people are avoiding going to the hospital when they need it. There have been increased incidences of people waiting for when they have appendicitis and other severe illnesses before they go to the ER. And that has, in some areas, the risk of people waiting to go to the ER or not going to the ER where they need to has led to more deaths and more poor outcomes than COVID in those same areas.
So, Shemaine, that leads me to an important point as a follow-up. While elective procedures had been postponed, the urgent care systems, the emergency rooms, they have been open for business all along, right?
Right. Unfortunately, they've seen a huge drop-off in ER patients, and some of these people definitely should be in the ER. There was a press release from three Madison hospitals earlier this week where they said, if you are having a stroke or heart attack or anything else that needs urgent care, come to the emergency room or call 911. People are not going to the ER when they should. It's not just anecdotal. It's happening, Wisconsin hospitals say.
So hammering that point home, a life-threatening thing like a suspected stroke or heart attack, the risk of that going untreated is way worse than the risk of not going to a hospital, because of COVID-19. That's what you're hearing from those hospitals?
Exactly. I mean, while there is risk of catching COVID-19, there's increased risk of not treating a heart attack or some other ailment. I mean, you need care, and they're saying you should get it.
Shemaine, in our last minute or so, what are you watching for next when it comes to our health system in Wisconsin and how it's been affected by COVID-19?
Well, I was on a teleconference earlier today where a planned field hospital, a surge facility in Dane County at the Alliant Energy Center, has been put on hold. So we're all wondering when we're going to hit a peak in the state. Will the hospitals have enough capacity to treat these people, or will they have to go to these alternative care facilities like in Dane County that was planned or at State Fair Park? So everybody's got their eyes on the numbers. How many COVID cases do we have that require hospitalization? How bad could this get? Or maybe not. Maybe Wisconsin will be successful in flattening the curve.
Right. I guess the hope, I wasn't on that call. I guess the hope would be that social distancing measures worked well enough so that those peak measures don't have to come into play. Is that a fair statement?
Exactly. The deputy health secretary said, as long as we keep doing what we're doing, we'll be fine. But she pointed out this is, in her words, a ferocious virus, and it could get worse. So we have to be ready. But right now, that second surge facility in Dane County at the Alliance Center is on hold, but they're ready to resume if they need it.
Shemaine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to. Thanks, Rob.
That's Shemaine Mills, Madison-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. We talked to her about how some hospitals in the state are slowly beginning to perform elective surgeries again. Also took a look at furloughs at health centers around the state and other ways that hospitals are reacting to the COVID-19 outbreak. A lot of us are looking for excuses to get outside these days. And a couple of weeks back, we talked about the psychological value of gardening, big projects or small. Central Time producer Bill Martins hit the dirt this weekend. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Rob. How you doing?
Pretty good. Now, you shared some pictures. You had a lot of dirt on hand. What were you up to this weekend?
So it was actually last week while I was on vacation. I built raised garden bed. It's 4 feet wide, 12 feet long, 20 inches tall. Took 36 bags of dirt to fill it up.
Wow, that's a lot of work, so, too.
Yeah, it was. I was really glad to get to the end of it. I mean, I have fun doing that kind of stuff, but I was about done with it.
All right, now the big question is, what are you growing in this giant? We can call it giant raised garden bed.
Well, I think we're going to do a couple of at least, probably four tomato plants. My wife wants to plant some pickling cukes. I also want to do some eggplant and peppers. And we're still going to have some room after that, and we're kind of undecided on what to do with the rest of it.
Okay. Are you going to eat all this yourself, or is it going to show up on the produce giveaway table at Wisconsin Public Radio come August?
I don't know if it's going to find its way on the table. I'm a pretty prolific tomato eater, so I don't know. Maybe if... It's up in the air. I don't know.
All right. Thanks for the inspiration,
some?
Bill.
All right. See ya.
This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.